Hello, and welcome back to Proofing in Lies. I'm your host, Elle Rochford. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Delaware's Center for the Study and Prevention of Gender-Based Violence. I have my PhD in sociology, and I have no degrees in baking. And this week, I am talking to Emily Newman, whose book on political fashion is coming out soon. And in honor of this fashionista and our talk on fashion, I tried to make a very high fashion tart. This is a deceptively easy tart to make. I used a short crust recipe for the tart shell, and then I just poured in chocolate ganache. This is like a huge crowd pleaser, and it always looks so fancy and so beautiful, but it's so simple. So for your chocolate ganache, you want it to set up really firm. So I would say heat your cream below boiling and then add twice the amount of chocolate to your cream. So that's a 1-to-2 ratio there, or a 2-to-1 if you want to flip it. When your cream is hot, stir in the chocolate, take it off the heat, and stir till smooth. I like to add a little bit of flavor to the cream as I heat it. So I infused it with coffee. So this was kind of a chocolate coffee, just a light hint of coffee tart. And then when the ganache was still cooling, so it still had quite a bit of liquidity, I melted white chocolate and drizzled kind of a half circle around the tart. So just on one side, and then I feathered it so that it has this sort of semi-circle of white chocolate feathering. And I added one of my favorite touches, a pressed flower by Kate Lowry. Kate is my wonderful friend who works out of a state park in Dayton, and she presses these wonderful edible flowers. So she is my supplier, and I can't resist popping a beautiful little flower on everything I make now. I will throw some pictures up on my Instagram, Proofing and Lies. Feel free to follow us on Twitter if you're still there. It is not quite the website it used to be, but we are there, Proofing and L, the letter L. So check us out, follow us, and as always, like, share, subscribe, all of that helps. Any reviews we get are quite helpful to us to circulate, so definitely leave a review if you can. Thanks so much and enjoy this interview. Hello and welcome to Proofing in Lies. This week we are talking with Dr. Emily Newman from Texas A&M Commerce, the Department of Liberal Arts. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. I am really excited to talk to you. You have a book that recently came out, correct?
Right, yes.
And it is on political protest and fashion. Is that?
Yeah. And a little bit into art and kind of how all these things come together to be successful.
I'm so excited to listen to you talk about your book. So one of the like fun facts I like to share with people is that like wedge-heeled high heels come out of Nazi-occupied Paris, and just the way that our fashions change around world events, because, and it had to do with all of these things around rationing and shoemaking, but also like trying to demoralize the Parisians and the fashion capital. And so I have kind of a niche interest in this. So this was a very selfish ask of me to have you on, because I just genuinely want to hear, you know, what drew you to this topic.
Thanks. I think it all kind of started because I was watching the Women's March on TV, and I knew a lot of people who were marching in DC and locally in Dallas. And I was feeling very depressed about the election of Donald Trump to office. And my response was to like hole up and just not leave the house. So I was envious of the protests, at the same time not feeling like I could participate in them. And my friend had knitted me a pussy hat. So I like put it on my dog and took pictures and was like, oh, that's my way of participating. And then later in the day, I like donated to the ACLU and bought my dog a shirt for the ACLU. Like I was just kind of not involved, but wanting to be involved. And I'm like not a great crowd person. Like I said, I'm generally a homebody and introvert. And so I was feeling sort of distanced from the whole effort. But as time went on, I couldn't really get away from the pussy hats. I was just sort of interested in how they became used, and they became the kind of view of this protest. And you would see these pictures of the movement, and there were just seas of pink hats, and I just thought it was really incredible. So I kind of investigated that and did my first conference paper in a while on that topic, and met with a publisher who liked it and was like, why don't you expand it out? And so I kind of used that as an excuse to look at things I've always been interested in, like the pantsuit, which is seeing such a resurgence this moment. Even as I was writing the book, it was becoming more and more popular. But, you know, I think one of the great stories about the pantsuit is no one knows exactly. There's a couple different origin stories, but women weren't allowed to wear pants in the Congress or in the Senate, until the 90s. And 90s? It was like an unspoken rule. So when Carol Moseley Brown got elected, she just was like, I'm going to wear what I wore when I was on the, you know, in the state Senate in Illinois. And so she wore pants one day, and it was like, oh my gosh, she wore pants. And then she was Black. And, you know, it was just like this huge thing. Meanwhile, there's another senator who was pushing for the rules to change and kind of worked at it from that angle. So eventually, like, I think it was in 93, they were allowed to wear pants on the Senate floor in DC. But like,
so just, I am older than congressional leaders being allowed to wear pants.
It's just like
Hercules, the Disney movie, came out before. I don't know why that's my frame of reference. I'm just trying to, Jurassic Park is as old.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Wild. So it's been really interesting to see them now, especially like on the red carpet and women wearing pants to the Oscars, which was so taboo, like just a few years ago. So, you know, that was a chapter I kind of had to fight for, because the publisher was sort of like, the history of pantsuits and, you know, Marlene Dietrich, that's a little more well known, and that they were worn by queer women. And there's a history with that. That's a little bit more known. But I just think that thinking of them in terms of like a statement beyond sexuality and in terms of gender and being more vocal and visual about it is really powerful.
I'm curious, does your book or is this outside of the scope of your research? Do you talk about Zoot Suits at all and the Zoot Suit riots?
I don't, but I love them. They're just so fabulous. Like, I don't even wear pantsuits, honestly, because pantsuits are hard if you have boobs. I feel like you're very self-conscious, at least I am. But the Zoot Suits are just like, there's a confidence in them because they're so oversized, you know, too, that like you take up like extra physical space that I just feel like is so powerful.
There's something so fascinating about them. And I've discovered that like a lot of Americans don't know that Zoot Suits, number one, are a style of suit. Like, it's not just like a funny part of that song, but we're like this really intense political statement. And were like Chicana women who were active in different protest movements. I would love if you just talked at me about some of the things you've seen in your work, because this is such an amazing, I think often overlooked part of political movements is the styling of them.
I think one of the things that I really had fun with was the book is that I'm a bit of a pop culture nerd, and like, so the film Working Girl has always been a film that like I loved, my mom loved, like the Carly Simon, like Let the River Run song is like inspirational in our life. And so I went back to that film and looked at how she dressed and how they portrayed her as she was getting more accepted, I guess, as she basically, you know, stole her boss's costumes or her, you know, that were her outfits and her hair and everything. So I think that's one of the things that's a thread I really like. So I was stuck on this one chapter of my book. I was going to look at waitress uniforms and, you know, I was thinking about restaurants. I don't know if you've heard that term, but yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah.
It's always a fun term to bring up around people because they're like restaurants, but it's, you know, like the idea of Hooters, just in case anyone doesn't know, but the idea that, you know, like women wear like very revealing outfits, and it's all for show and tips and
growth. I very unfortunately thought Twin Peaks was a David Lynch themed bar, and it is not. It is a restaurant. The Twin Peaks are a euphemism. So I was quite surprised when I went into one.
I thought that at first, well, myself. We had a place called Burger Girl that I was like, oh, that's so great. Like a burger shop owned by a woman. And it was the same. It was a restaurant. And I just.
Yeah, I think Tilted Kilt is similar, yeah. I think. There's like, I feel like a genre for these Absolutely. Beyond Hooters.
And what's interesting is Hooters at the time I was thinking about too, they were trying to do this, and I think they still are, but like this different kind of to-go place called Hooties, where the women are wearing like slightly more conservative apparel, and it was appealing to families to like come buy chicken strips or something. But I was kind of stuck with where to go with that, because we all know it's like just playing on sex sells and food and kind of gross. And so as I was doing what I do, which is watch TV in the background of everything, the new season of The Handmaid's Tale was on. And so I started thinking about their outfits and the costumes and Margaret Atwood's take. And because the book was, it's like a living thing, you know, and you work on it for 3, 4, or 5 years. Amy Comet Barrett was nominated for the Supreme Court. And turns out in her religion, which the internet has scrubbed a lot, so we don't know a ton about People of Praise, which is the group that she belongs to, but we know from a directory that she was a handmaid. Like that was actually her title in this organization, which was defined as like a woman's leader in the group. But because it was very male centric, that means not a lot. But basically that, like, my understanding is that you would basically teach other women how to be good wives and maintain the house. But so, like, literally Trump nominated this handmaid to the Supreme Court. So women showed up wearing the costumes from The Handmaid's Tale. And they started, they'd done that before with Brett Kavanaugh, who, when he was nominated, became pretty clear that he was a predator of many sorts. But so the visibility of the Handmaid's Tale outfit became something I was really interested in, and sort of looking at it from Atwood's perspective, where she's using red, but I would argue more specifically like a minstrel red, really brutally referring to what the handmaids in the show were supposed to do, which was to give birth and give their babies to the people who were richer and who hypothetically were more prepared to take care of them. And so looking at her costumes and the power of color, and then investigating red. And so then I'm looking at, and it shows you kind of the chaotic way my mind works, but I'm like, well, Christian Louboutin and the red shoes, or the soles of the red shoes that he always uses, and the way that Dior, not, well, you see some Dior, but, oh, Valentino, duh. Valentino, you know, he always includes a red dress in his fashion. Well,
and Valentino had that, pink was the, like, Valentino pink. I don't know if I just stepped on your point, but.
No. And shocking pink with Elsa Schiaparelli too has a long history. So dancing on that, when Valentino retired, everyone, you know, who's anyone, came out, and this was in around 2007, 2008, and walked in his last runway, and they all wore the same red dress. So there's just kind of this repetitious use of red dress and red. And then, I don't know, again, like it's like this weird kind of jumble of things, but Tiger Woods also wears red on the last day of golf tournaments. So on the Sunday of most golf tournaments, he wears a red shirt. Because for him, red is a power color, which it generally is thought to be. And so it's kind of meant to be not just power for him to kind of, I think, give him that boost, but now it's also about an intimidation factor. So red is like this really intense, powerful color, but it's also the color of menstruation, which we don't like to talk about, like as a society, right? And yet here, Atwood and Anne Crabtree, I should say, who designed the costumes, very much based on what Atwood wanted, are using this specific dark red to make this kind of broader statement about how women are used by our bodies and controlled by our bodies. And then Pantone comes out and makes period red to try to raise awareness about menstrual care with the help of this group in Sweden. And so like, there's all these like confluences of red and power and women coming up that just to me felt like it becomes more than just coincidence, right? It becomes a kind of larger statement on like, we want to say that red is this powerful color. We want to encourage women to wear it. The American Heart Association has Wear Red Days to draw awareness to heart disease, which women suffer from, but don't often get attention. They even do a fashion show almost every year. So it's like, we're encouraged to wear red. We're encouraged to embrace it, but it's also like, we can't show period blood in commercials, right? So there's this like weird gap. I think
that's about. So related to the menstruation, right? In Handmaid's Tale, you get women are separated out, not just from the men, but between women who have functioning reproductive systems and those who don't, right? And so it's desirable to be young, to be menstruating. That's what makes you valuable in a society that values the reproduction of women. But at the same time, it's what makes you lesser than men, right? Yeah. So red is you want a menstruating woman, but you don't want her menstruating, which I think is kind of the classic bind of being a young woman.
Absolutely. And then, you know, we want this young, pretty woman on the fashion runway, right? But you know, we don't want her dried up.
She's right. And famously, you know, a lot of runway models don't menstruate anymore because the bodies that we find desirable in young women are not capable of menstruation because of the caloric intake necessary to maintain those figures.
It's wild. So I'm thinking of all these things and all of a sudden I'm introduced to this, the Red Dress Project by Jamie Black, who's an Indigenous artist working in Canada. And her project involves collecting red dresses, like sometimes gathering them from the community. The community is really important. And often hanging them from trees and trying to draw attention to the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and Two Spirits movement, the hashtag MMIWG2S. It's a mouthful, but it's recently been expanded to be more inclusive. So I just want to make sure to mention that. And so that kind of took on this whole other interest where red is used in Native communities to connect to the spirit world a lot of times. And so here in these red dresses, they become these almost ghosts hanging in trees. She also does them in gallery spaces inside too, but that you want to learn more about, want to understand, but then also recognizing that, okay, like both the United States and Canada has, you know, a serious blind spot when it comes to missing and murdered Native peoples, particularly women and girls and Two Spirits. Then I try to zoom out and like combine all these things somehow, right? And sort of connect, okay, we're looking at red as power and the way that it's been used by all these different groups to kind of make a statement, but how intimately it's connected to women and power, but also kind of abuse too, in a way. And just, I think part of my goal, I think when I write too, is to like open people's eyes and just get them to be more observant, but paying attention to what you wear and what you see. I think, you know, as a teacher, I try to get students just to think more about their choices, right? And so, yeah, you go to grab a t-shirt and wear it that day, but that's a choice. And what's on that t-shirt is a choice. And, you know, so when Tiger Woods goes to his closet before the last day of his golf tournament, I imagine he has a whole slew of red Nike shirts that he's debating on wearing, you know, and that's going to be his statement for the day. And so there's various projects that use red and the red dress, or Handmaid's Tale outfits, you know, to make this bold statement. And on the flip side of that is, you know, there's this really terrible website called Yandy that makes like Halloween costumes, but the slutty versions, you know? And so they actually made a slutty Handmaid's Tale costume.
I mean, honestly, the parody, like there's almost something, it goes so far that it almost becomes good again. Like, yeah. a fine line of satire there.
Yeah. So people freaked out and they apologized and took it down. But it was wild. It's wild to see things come back around like that. And for people to kind of step back and try to take that in stride, I think is something that I'm kind of keen on. And so I guess, you know, I keep coming back to also t-shirts because I love t-shirts. They're the core of my wardrobe. I work from home a lot. So it's like t-shirt and sweatpants, you know, is like generally like my favorite thing and always has been. And so one of the things is I become increasingly politically aware just growing up and, you know, being able to articulate what feminism really means other than just like knowing I was a feminist. I've been drawn to clothing that proclaims that. And so a part of my book also looks at this industry that's kind of arisen of feminist clothing, but with a charitable bent. So the idea that when I'm watching the Women's March and I'm feeling sad and frustrated, you know, just a couple months before that, The Outrage, which is one of my favorite organizations, was started. And they came about because Trump called, you know, us nasty women who had things to say, right? The idea was, I think any woman that was vocal and disagreed with him was a nasty woman. And so
I have a nasty woman magnet that one of my sisters sent me. Yeah.
So The Outrage made shirts that's a nasty woman. And then they just gradually have expanded and expanded over time. But I got there pretty close to the beginning and just have so many various shirts from different organizations like these. And I feel I can justify it a little bit because I'm like, well, some of it goes to charity. Right. But I'm also wearing it in public. And, you know, I live in Texas, which is a fairly conservative state. And I don't typically care what I wear, but there's a couple things that I've always wondered about. And there was not long after Parkland, the shooting at Parkland in Florida, there was a movement to wear orange and protest gun control. And The Outrage made these shirts that just advocated to resist and to walk out. And they were bright orange to tie in with their discussion. And I got one and, you know, I obviously got it after the big date and whatever, but there was another call a few months later to do the same. And I knew in Texas, there weren't going to be people walking out because Texas, but I like had it on that day just because I like to feel like I'm a part of things, even if I'm at my house. And I ran to Target and a young woman working there told me she liked the shirt. And it was like this very little thing, but it was like, yeah, that's kind of why I want to wear these clothes. Because it's easy to ignore or just like see someone roll their eye at me. But to people it matters too. There's a visibility and a connection that happens that I think you can't really get any other way. Like, it's not like I would just randomly start talking with this woman who works at Target about my feelings on gun control are, you know, schools, students and faculty making statements. But through this t-shirt, we were kind of able to connect and see each other. And in a place like Texas where you feel isolated, if you feel certain ways, that was a really powerful little moment for me. So I know we could be like, oh, you know, capitalism, it's all about making money. But I just don't like that approach. To me, that feels sort of overdone and boring. I'm more interested, and perhaps naively so, but thinking about the potential for these kind of connections. And so what's cool about a group like The Outrage, where they have a physical store in DC and I think in Philadelphia, they're trying to expand more, but it's tough in this climate, but is that they have a phone booth that you can call your senators and representatives. And they have a script for you to say. And when you check out to buy something, they ask if you're registered to vote. So it's capitalistic in that they sell things, but there's this intent to kind of engage things further. The other organization I like is Phenomenal, which is Mina Harris's company. It's had many iterations, but it kind of got its name from the poem by Maya Angelou, Phenomenal Woman. And that was the first design of the shirt she made. And now it's like this media conglomerate, and she's like producing films and Broadway and all sorts of crazy things. But again, like the heart of the company is also these shirts, and it changed from Phenomenal Woman to Phenomenal Mother, Phenomenal Teacher, Phenomenally Black, and different kind of ways of engaging. And then you have the same kind of going to charity. But I was thinking about your podcast and if I had any connections to baking too, and anything I read. And my favorite sweatshirt from them, they did a, I think 2 years ago, but it says sugar and spice and reproductive rights. And they also worked with a cookbook author and sold spices at the same time. So there's these interesting ways that like we can use our fashion to make these statements, both with our money and within, you know, a certain amount of budget, right? Because t-shirts are affordable to some extent. I clarify that just, but this idea that, yeah, we can wear certain things. And so I've taken to going to conferences, but also like the first kind of couple weeks when I teach in person, like, okay, today I'm going to wear like a progress flag pin, or I'm going to wear, I have a Get in Good Trouble shirt because I'm a big John Lewis fan and have taught courses on social justice. So I want them to kind of see through what I wear, some of my beliefs, maybe without me saying so, especially like the progress pride flag. Like I want them to know I'm an ally without being like, hey, I'm an ally. Like, you know, so that there's this more subtle form of engagement. I'm not outing anyone, but I want them to know I'm a safe space. And I think fashion, if you choose to do so, can actually say that for you.
Oh, I totally buy into this, right? This is definitely how I think about my own personal style, because I think, I mean, it's visual communications, right? You are signaling different orientations to the world. And I think if people are skeptical of this, if you open a dating app, you can get a sense of like, oh, I know what this person's politics are just by like the style of clothing they're wearing right here. Or, you know, I've certainly been in this situation, right? You see someone's tote bag and you're like, okay, I know I have a bead on what kind of person this is. And I think particularly among white people, where we did see, you know, 50% of white women voting for Trump, having these visual cues of like, oh, I can feel safe with you, to a certain extent, right? There's a lot of other more nuanced political, you know, conversations to be had there. But just these visual cues that you can quickly assess, you know, your safety in any given social situation or your level of comfort.
Yeah.
I see fashion as hugely important for those things.
And I think with students too, especially in a place where they might feel more vulnerable, they're so important. And we have some students that are obviously, you know, hyper conscious of it, but then you have the students that don't fully think about it and that their mom bought their clothes or something. So again, it's that like, think about your choices. Think about when you roll out of bed and just grab a shirt, there's still like a history of that shirt somewhere, you know, even if it's a credit card shirt that you got free at college to try to get you to sign up. I mean, that's, you've been manipulated by the credit card people, right? Or you're manipulating them to get the free shirt, but that there's a process there that I think is so interesting and often doesn't get as discussed as much as I like it to see. And especially with t-shirts, I mean, they're so affordable, and yet there's this, you know, constant thing. I mean, the whole reason t-shirts are popular is because sailors started wearing them in the 19-teens and 20s. They saw them and they were like, oh, these are convenient. You know, they're quick, they dry fast, like, great. So they started wearing them. And it was very much, they became part of their official uniform and they wore it. It wasn't until like James Dean and Marlon Brando wore t-shirts that they were cool. And
that's so fascinating.
Yeah. So there's, you know, very famous pictures of them in their like t-shirts. I just think of the little rolled up cuffs of their white t-shirts, right? Looking uber masculine, and, you know, the rebels, right? Rebel without a cause. So that's when you start to see t-shirts enter the mainstream. Then screen printing got better in the 60s and 70s. So every rock person wanted to have their say, and then that they got popular with bands. But so now they're just sort of ubiquitous, to the point where you have fashion designers kind of using them. And so when I mentioned t-shirts are affordable, the part of my brain that's going at the same time is like, well, there was this t-shirt that Dior made that said, we should all be feminists. And they have another, why are there no great women artists, where they're referencing very famous articles and texts. And all the celebrities are like, these are great. And of course, I'm like, these are great, but also they're $800. So,
well, and there's a big push now as like the influencer class is aging and developing their own businesses, right? The Kylie and Kendall Jenners, right? They're into quiet luxury, quote unquote. So they're wearing these, you know, obscenely expensive t-shirts and cargo pants.
And sweatpants. Oh, I love the luxury sweatpants movement just because I feel like it justifies my love of sweatpants. But
that's actually the word I meant. I don't think either of them wear cargo pants. Sweatpants is what I meant there. Nothing says quiet luxury like cargo pants.
Right. I know the guy who did the whole history of cargo pants. It's really amazing what you can do the history of these days. But I think, you know, it's really fascinating to me. And when I travel, even like my pajama t-shirts, I'm like, is this going to be okay? Am I going to anger anyone? Like there's certain shirts, you know, my mom's been like, I don't like it when you wear super political shirts. I'm like, whatever, fine. Or like I wore a hysterical female shirt once around my granddad who was like, I don't think you're hysterical. And it was just like, okay, like you want to explain it, but there's levels of it. But it's been really interesting to kind of start to pay attention, push people to pay attention more that way. And then one of the newer things that's happened really in the past year and a half, 2 years, is green bandanas becoming the symbol for like abortion rights. And that's coming out of South America and Argentina in particular. They used green bandanas to advocate for their abortion freedom, to have access to it.
We did a green bandana giveaway my office. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the Argentinian women won remarkably the right to abortion. As in the US, we are losing our access. So AOC and Cori Bush and a couple other people were protesting and got arrested. And those pictures went big and they had green bandanas on. So lesser known, but like a more international symbol, which I like too. So, and of course, I have a green bandana for my dog, if you haven't gotten, who's a male dog, but he very much supports all causes, you know.
I love a politically active dog. Well, depending on their politics.
Right.
I feel like there's a t-shirt opportunity there for like paw-litics, where it's like paws.
Paws over patriarchy. That was one of my favorite shirts the Outrage made. Four dogs. They also made a great one when Trump was president, as he doesn't even have a dog. Because Trump actually was one of the first presidents to have any kids, which I think is kind of telling when you actually think about the compassion it takes to have an animal. And even though like we know like, okay, Barack Obama didn't like take care of his dogs like himself all the time, but he still had dogs. Like
it's such an easy thing to do to like make yourself, to humanize yourself. And I think the fact that he opted out of that, because you're right. I mean, all you have to do is have the dog in name and then have staff take care of it. And that was not even on his radar, I think.
Right. Or even a cat or a hamster, for heaven's sake. Like blame Baron, but you know, he's just not into that. So I loved that little shirt because it was something I hadn't thought about, and now it's like it's just like, because even I've been to the George W. Bush Library, is not too far from where I live, and they had an Oscar de la Renta exhibition once because Laura Bush wore a lot of his gowns, and so it was a great show. But so I'm like, well, I'm here, so I'm going to walk through the president part of it, and they had, you know, little monuments to all the animals they had in the White House. Like it was important, you know, like they're this important association with the president. So Trump not having any animals was quite telling, because you think of, I'm drawing blanks on names of all the past animals, but Sox, I think, was the Clinton's cat.
Checkers was Nixon's.
Yeah.
Like I remember.
Lore almost.
Well, and I think, I mean, Pence wrote a whole novel about his little bunny that he had.
Because of course I heard about that through the other novel that was written about the gay bunny, you know.
That is also what I that it was how I was introduced to that topic as well. And I
But even Major, you know, Biden's dog, you know, who may or may not have bit someone and is now living a happy life in Delaware. Like, you know, we are fascinated. We love animals in this country, I think we can say in the world. And so, yeah, like, you know, I have this weird habit when I go, there's certain like fashion sites I go, like even Anthropology, I'll go to Anthropology online and I'll search a dog just to see if they have any shirts with a dog on them that are cute that I can pass off for work or something.
I wonder.
No one hates a dog shirt. I mean, like they're generally beloved.
Well, so you say that, but growing up, it was like you were considered a ridiculous person if you put clothes on your dog.
True.
And now that's totally different. Like it used to be something that was stereotyped, like only like white women did it and they only did it with these frou-frou little dogs. But now I think it is way more acceptable. You know, I think all the dogs in my family have like little LL Bean vests. Like, I feel like that is relatively new.
I do too. And I think it's like, we're moving from like what you were saying, the crazy cat lady, right? This like thing. And I think of the Kathy cartoon too. You
yeah. know? Yeah.
This idea of like the crazy single woman, and now is like singledom is so much more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And you look at the numbers, like more people are living alone than ever before. More people are choosing not to have children. Like, and I mean, that's,
yeah.
Totally. I'm taking my maternal instincts out on my dog, 100%. Like he has a closet in my house. It's disgusting. Like,
well, and I love that, right?
But it's also like, yeah, I'm not going to have kids. And like, I like to, like, it became kind of a fun thing to find different shirts on sale. And, you know, he has a costume every year. And, but I think it is filling this kind of void that didn't exist in the same ways before. So now it's like less making fun of, but just like, oh, that's, you know, that's kind of standard. And we love dogs now and we're open about it. And I mean, I don't know about you, but like on Instagram, I follow like Noodle was like my beloved dog. Oh, I'm still like RIP.
The little pug.
You know, I've got my No Bones Day sticker on my computer and follow other dogs' accounts. So it's also, I think, and this weirdly ties back into kind of what I was saying about my book, it's a distraction that helps us when like the world is sad. And I know that's not like the most articulate way to say it, but I honestly kind of believe that like the world is sad right now. Like when you watch the nightly news, it is one shooting after another. Hey, COVID's still around. Like Sudan is falling apart. Like it's just bad news after bad news after bad news. So if you have these little tiny or big, I should say, animals that can make you smile, like what better thing, right?
Well, and I think about too, tying this into your book, like the collective grief, the isolation we all felt during COVID, t-shirts, clothes for your dogs, that's such a low stakes, like expression of intimacy, right? During COVID, I had to move a few times and every once in a while, I'll see like a t-shirt or like there's a little hat that says big sad with like floral embroidery, right? And so I send that off to my friend because I'm thinking of them. Or, yeah. You know, my sister, I bought her dog a turtleneck. He doesn't need that. But like, I don't have nieces and nephews yet. So like when I'm thinking of them and I'm trying to like express this sense of like, I am thinking of you, I feel like t-shirts are a way we show like I'm listening to your interests and I care about you and I think about you. So I think there is something about a t-shirt that can create community.
Right.
The t-shirts I have are largely gifts. So mm-hmm. I am not a t-shirt person. Before COVID, I did not own sweatpants. I had to buy like pajama pants because suddenly I didn't need my business casual wardrobe. But to this day, I don't really buy t-shirts. The t-shirts I have all been gifts. And so it is kind of funny walking through my closet. You can kind of see what my relatives think of me and the work I do because of the sort of things right. They send me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I can't believe you didn't have sweatpants though. I weirdly like used COVID to justify buying like sweatpants all the more. Like I just built up. I live in Texas and I have probably 30 sweatshirts. Like it's absurd the amount of sweatshirts I have, but they're like my comfort blankets in sweatshirt form. And I think it's interesting too, because as you were talking about that, I was thinking about, you know, in 2020, I guess it, when was it, no, 2020 was Biden. So 2016, when Hillary was running against Trump, right before the elections, there was this Facebook group that became really popular, right? That was like Pantsuits for Clinton, Pantsuit Nation, I'm sorry. And
I know exactly what that is. Yeah.
And so they put out a call, right, to wear pantsuits when you go vote for Hillary. And it was like this wonderful thing. And I remember I had yoga in the morning of election day. So I wore like a blazer, like a knit blazer over my like yoga outfit, because I was like so happy and like so excited to be voting for her and vote for a woman and vote for change. I mean, there's so much hope that day. And people, you know, like they love to put "I voted" stickers on Susan B. Anthony's grave, right? Since she helped us secure the right to vote. But there was very much this spirit of like, okay, we're going to wear pantsuits when we go vote for her, so you could look around. And it's that secret communication that you have again. And so what was so cool then in 2020 was Kamala Harris getting the vice presidency. And when she did it, when she like accepted the nomination, it was like Saturday night, and she wore this beautiful Carolina Herrera cream suit and pearls. And pearls are her signature piece of jewelry, which actually goes back. She's a sorority member, and pearls were there.
I was going to say, yeah.
And so she, and it goes even back further. A friend of her mom's gave her pearls when she was younger. And so that was always her cherished thing. So there was another Facebook group that was created that said, wear pearls and checks when you went to vote for Biden and Harris. And it was much more diverse, as you might expect, than Pantsuit Nation. It was really led by Black women. And they were like so excited. And on election day, you couldn't refresh the page fast enough because people were posting pictures of the pearls, and they didn't have to be real pearls. I mean, I even saw like Mardi Gras beads, you know, it didn't matter. And all the different chucks, and some of the women had painted their chucks with, you know, Harris, Biden, 2020. I mean, just elaborate. And there's something about that that's so wonderful. And I told my mom, you know, is, well, I'm from Oklahoma. So, you know, I grew up Republican, you know, that's kind of the way you should be. And that's how she grew up as well. And so it was a big election for a lot of women, I think, as we still know, white women failed us, but she did vote for Hillary. And she wore a pearl necklace when she voted for Biden. And she works at a hospital, and she saw someone else in a pearl necklace, and she said, "Oh, I like your pearls." And they had this like whole exchange in a hospital that's not, you know, not political. And certainly like in Oklahoma, you know, it was coded, like, "I side with you" kind of comment that was so cool for my mom, who's not political at all. Like, I'm her, you know, very liberal, outspoken daughter. So that it allowed for these, and that group still exists on Facebook, and they still post pictures. So the Facebook group Pearls and Chucks is still alive today, and it's still around, and they're posting pictures, and you can go and you can see, and it's 50th birthday and I'm wearing my pearls to celebrate, or, "Oh, I got my daughter her first pearls and she's wearing them." And there's something sort of just so pure and wholesome about that, that I just like, it lifts your mood sort of instantly. And there's such a power in that as well. And I think that sometimes we're so quick to dismiss fashion, right? And it's so gendered, of course. And, you know, we don't want to talk about appearance. I was watching this new show on Netflix, The Diplomat, and Carrie Russell is the lead. And she's, of course, you know, she played Felicity and cut her hair, and it was catastrophic, right? But the whole point in this show is that she doesn't care about her appearance. So her hair is constantly a mess, to the point where I'm like, that's just not realistic. Like, there's no way she would not brush her hair. I'm sorry. Like, I just don't buy that. But, you know, it's this whole perception, oh, fashion doesn't matter. So there's kind of a running joke that she doesn't care about what she wears or her hair on that show, when in reality, like, it is important what you wear. And
yeah. Particularly if you work in politics as a woman, you are going to be thinking about these things.
You can't, but we don't like to talk about it. We don't want to acknowledge it. And we don't want it to be important, right? We don't want to care what Hillary Clinton wears. And yet that's all we talked about practically when she was going up for election. And I got better with Kamala Harris and some of my favorite fashion bloggers. I don't know if you've heard of Tom and Lorenzo, but they're a really great duo. And they refuse to cover her fashion because they're like, it doesn't matter what she wears. She's a political leader. Like, we don't want it to be distracting.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of cool. But at the same time, like, you know, you see this with the royal family too. Like, what they wear matters, what designer you wear matters, depending on where you are, right? When you, when you're Kate Middleton and you go to Canada, which is one of your territories, you know, like you're going to try to wear a Canadian designer to make Canadians happy, right? So it's like, there's so much more about fashion that we don't want to say, that we don't want to kind of acknowledge. And I think that's so silly. Like, so I think part of my book was just trying to give fashion studies a little bit more cred. And that's not to say I'm the first to do that, that there aren't fashion museums. But like, if we look at it more in like mainstream sort of ways, I think we can start to take it a little more seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think it's such a, to me, fascinating idea that like fashion shouldn't be taken seriously. I was just talking, so University of Delaware has a research center on disaster. And so I was talking with some sociologists who study disaster response, and we were talking about the gender imbalance of who dies in natural disasters. And it's much more likely to be women. And part of it is that in a lot of places, particularly with conservative values, women are wearing way more fabric. So in things like tsunamis or any kind of mass flooding, they're more likely to drown because they're wearing all of these layers of clothes, and they're much more likely to be at home and be responsible for caring for the elderly and for the young. But these fashion choices, which are very culturally and politically driven, right, have really direct, you know, kind of a straight line impact on your safety, on how you move through a space. You know, I think watching fashion trends is so fascinating to me, right? The way that you have to kind of control and monitor your body to work with certain fashions, like resurgence of the low-rise jean, right? It's interesting to see that coming back at a time when we're seeing restricted women's rights, right? Yeah. And then you have the counter of we're seeing these like beautiful, voluminous sculptural dresses and tulle dresses kind of pushing back against like take up space.
Right. There was this huge scandal in Brazil when Hillary Clinton went there, and she wore a skirt suit. Mm-hmm. And she had her picture taken, as they do, you know, and they had, this is when she was first lady, and she was seated in like a front row, and there was a big group shot. And apparently, like, you could just like see a sliver of her underwear if you looked the right way, which was horrendous on every level. And some lingerie company like blew up the picture and tried to use ads for it like instantaneously after it happened. And she was horrified, and they had it taken down. And that was the last time she wore like a skirt in like public events. And just this idea that it could be so manipulated and horrible, and the way that we have to be strategic about our clothes, women too, more than men, right? Like, I mean, that story is incredible about women dying more because they have more clothing on, but it's so true. I mean, like, I had a banquet last night, and I was like, okay, like, I'm going to wear a dress, but what do I wear over the dress? Can I pull off a jean jacket? Like, is that too informal? Like, you know, and it's just not fair when they can wear a shirt, a suit, and a tie and call it a day and don't have to think about it. Right. And so I'm constantly kind of thinking about my choices like that. And that story that I just told about Hillary Clinton too is so interesting because she has written, I think, 3 memoirs, because, you know, they have to write one when they go up for president.
Yeah.
And I've read them all. And that story didn't come out till she made her Apple TV show in just last year in 2022. Because I think it was, she didn't feel comfortable talking about it at the time. And on this show, she's, you know, with her daughter, and they're talking about these kind of issues. So I think she can feel a little bit more able to open up more. But she didn't tell that story until then, which I thought was really interesting and really powerful.
I mean, it's just such the invasion of women's bodies and privacy when it comes to fashion. I mean, I think about this as someone who wears a lot of skirts and dresses and teaches at a college. I always will take a day where I'm not going to be on campus to try to wear something around, because you never know how it's going to move. And I think there's this surveillance that women do of their own bodies and spaces precisely because we know there are people out there who will, you know, blow up a photo because you make any kind of movement that reveals anything. And so that's just constantly in your mind.
There's this great scene in the show with Claire Danes, My So-Called Life, that was formative for me, apparently, because it like haunts me to this day, where she's eating lunch. You know, she's like a sophomore, I think, in high school. She's eating lunch with her teacher. And the fact that she's seeing her teacher eat is kind of weird because, you know, there's that kind of moment when you're a kid and you realize your teacher are people, not just authority. So she's kind of dealing with some of that, but then the woman's bra strap keeps sliding down, and that's all Claire Danes, who's the narrator, can like see and focus on. And they talk about the way her bra strap comes down and out. And it's something that's like haunted me my whole life, like my bra strap and teaching. Yeah. Like it's something I'm so hyper aware of. And it's so stupid. It's so inane. You know, I think of like Carrie on Sex and the City kind of made bra straps cool and, you know, was able to work them into her outfits. But it's interesting how those sort of moments stay with us all. And my first plane trip when I was 13 and I went to DC with my class, my mom wouldn't let me take any jeans because that was just, it was too slobby. Like I couldn't wear jeans on the plane. Oh no. We had to dress up for the plane. Like it was still this kind of mentality. And I remember my friend being like, I can pack your jeans if you want to. And I'm like, no, my mom will find out. Like she's that kind of mom. Like, but you know, like the idea that, yeah, people dressed up to go on planes, you know, and now I'm totally the worst, you know, I'm like, again, in sweatpants because I'm going to be sitting for 10 hours. And so I just think there's just so many things that like we're so caught up in thinking about that we don't even realize how much these impact our choices and our confidence and the way that we live and we engage the world, and that it's so important, and that we can't kind of keep neglecting it. And I'm so excited to see men's fashion get more exciting and see like the red carpet and men have choices and things like that. So it's like exciting to see that they have more opportunities. And I love like kind of this new gender neutrality moment we're seeing. So just like, it's so nice to like see that maybe we'll move beyond the binary, and hopefully fashion, which I think it's fair to say, especially with fashion designers, it's progressive, right? It trickles down, of course. The famous blue sweater speech from Devil Wears Prada, right? You know, about how I picked this color and cerulean, and that's why you're wearing it today. But this idea that a fashion being kind of ahead of the curve, I can only hope that like that is really what happens to society, right? That we're looking at in fashion this more acceptance of different bodies finally, and more just neutral clothing and less binary, that's what we're going to see in society in 5-10 years. And hopefully we get past some of this ridiculous kind of anti-trans, anti-gender non-conforming stuff and just let it be and move on and deal with real issues. But I like to see at least or think about fashion being kind of on the cutting edge and hopefully leading the way for some of those discussions.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, you do see that in, you know, the pioneers of the first women who were wearing trousers, right? They were, you know, revolutionary, not just in their fashion, but in their feminist politics, right? They were pushing, they needed the pants because they were doing activities that required pants, right? So
bicycles were a simple thing where women had to wear bloomers because they couldn't ride in skirts. Like, it's just so obvious when you think about, of course it happened.
So I think I think that is right. There is this, like, I think fashion pushes us to think differently because it's this creative art form, but it's also a material reality, right? We need the clothes to perform a function, right? And that function might be to resist these kind of gender norms.
Right. And to make statements and to declare your politics, or, you know, like either side, right? Like, you know, I think the pussy hats came out as this like great symbol of what could be in women's rights, but you have the Make America Great Again red cats that were often made in China, but became this own symbol. So that there's this weird push-pull between the pussy hat and this red cap and that legacy. And it's so interesting, even when you break down, you know, like the pussy hats being handmade and given away to people, and the spirit, like a craftivist spirit,
right,
an activist spirit that had them, and these hats that are made in a foreign country that are $35 and you know,
all uniform and
right, yeah. All exactly the same, all this statement that was America never great then or not great for a while, like, you know, like it's such like if when you start to examine just these little things, you can see all these big questions come out of them. And that's why I'm an art historian at heart, because these little things can say so much, yeah, about us. And that to me, I mean, that's like the thrill of my day, right? Like taking these things and showing and unpacking them and really studying them.
No, absolutely. So where can people find your book?
Yes. My book is officially called Fashioning Politics and Protest, New Visual Cultures of Feminism in the United States. And it's a Palgrave Macmillan published it. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it through Palgrave Macmillan. You can get it at independent bookstores. They can order it for you. It is also an ebook. It's expensive right now, so get your libraries to order it. And if enough libraries order it, they'll do a paperback, which will be half the price. So that's always the goal at first with these academic books, right? But also you can go to my website, which is just my name, emilylnewman.com. And you can see information on this book and my other books and what I'm doing. And you can reach out to me if you have questions or comments. I love to talk about this stuff, as you can hopefully see. So it's been really fun to talk to you and have this experience. It's just, I love this stuff. I love these kind of conversations. I think they're wild and fun.
Oh, likewise. Friend of the pod and friend of me in real life, Zach Palmer told me about your work. I was like, well, I need to talk to her.
Oh, thanks. I'm flattered. But yeah, it's important stuff, but fun stuff too. So you get a little mix of both. And then when he told me about your podcast, and I was like, baking and cool stuff. Oh, I'm down. I'm a failed baker. I want to be a baker, but I'm not great. So
I would say I'm a failed fashionista. So I think that works. Oh, I should see if I can make one of those Barbie doll cakes.
Those are so fun. Right? Oh my gosh, I love them. I'm obsessed with Barbie. That is another, like, one I've got. I feel like I've got a Barbie article in me somewhere.
Oh, especially with the film coming out. Oh my God.
Oh, I can't wait. Like, I'm just, my mom, when I finished my dissertation, which was on female body image in contemporary art, she had found all these scales that they sold with Barbies back in the day. Like they used to make a Barbie that came with the scale and a diet cookbook. Not even kidding. Oh my God. So I have this collection of little Barbie scales, which is the idea that Barbie needs a diet is, of course, like its own mind trickery sort of thing. But I just, Barbie to me fascinates. I mean, they just announced they did a Down syndrome Barbie for the first time.
It's oh.
Like, they're still, I feel like Barbie is like clawing its way and just trying to stay relevant and cool and hip, and I'm here for it. I want to see it all. I love it.
Yeah, I think one of the first Barbies that I remember really like loving, it was my Barbie, because I have older sisters, it was my Barbie. I think it was the Midge Barbie, because she had red hair.
Yeah.
But she came with a kitchen set, and so it was a baking Barbie.
Oh, how and funny.
Yeah, I don't remember if I loved baking as a kid or if I came to that later. But I do remember this Barbie. She came with her own little hand mixer and her own little oven, and she had red hair. And that was it for me. I loved it.
And Midge was like flat as a doorknob. I mean, just so flat. And I think she even had flat feet. Like, she was younger. Yeah.
Oh.
She was like in this, I think she's even younger than Skipper in the spectrum of things.
For some reason, I thought Midge was an adult, but I'm not up on Barbie lore.
She could be like, I mean, she's younger than Barbie, though. Supposed to be.
I'm pretty sure.
But she has, I know she's in the movie. Someone's playing Midge in the movie. Cause yeah. I was excited when I saw that. Cause she is a perfect example of like the redheaded stepchild that kind of got forgotten about constantly. She like only shows up every once in a while. Like,
but there was a very strong, at least in the 90s, that every friend group needed to have a redhead, a brunette, and a blonde.
Oh, yeah.
And I never saw that triad in real life, but it seemed every toy company had that model.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, it's American Girl doll, too.
Yeah.
which I'm also, you know, just fascinated by. So
American Girl doll fashion was incredible, because I just remember all of, like, my mom knew how to sew American Girl doll clothes. So like, we were pretty cool because we had custom clothes, but there would be like different people who'd make sort of bootlegged American Girl clothes and sell them.
We had like there was a flea market that made Barbie clothes. So we had like special one of a kind Barbie outfits that I just felt so cool with, because I feel like I was the older sister. So I was the like organizer, like dressing was more important. And then my younger sister wrote a play and I'm like, I'm bored. We've already dressed them. So.
Well, that was my dad's first move, would be to always throw away the Barbie shoes, because we were just going to lose them anyway. So he'd throw them away because he hated stepping on them. But as the third daughter, by the time I got a Barbie, their feet had been chewed off. So I don't think I saw a Barbie with feet until I got that Midge baking doll.
Funny.
Yeah. So I didn't know about the arched feet for a while.
Oh, and that's the best part of the trailer, when she steps out of the shoes. I can't wait. I'm so
excited. And there is a medical condition, like you shorten your arches as you wear those stilettos. So you actually can get that permanent Barbie. Yeah. They call it the Barbie foot.
I'll never have that problem, but don't wear high heels, but it's wild.
Yeah. I mean, like, we contort our bodies to fit fashion, but we also are, you know, equally acted upon by our fashion choices.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Well, it was absolutely delightful talking with you.
Yeah, so nice meeting you and speaking with you. A great time.
Everyone's going to have to check out the book.
I hope so.
A special thanks to Minelli Marcelino for our intro and outro music.